everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Joyce Salisbury about her biography of the 5th century Roman Empress Galla Placidia, entitled Rome's Christian Empress. Joyce, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm a retired professor from the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. I'm a professor of history and of religious studies. I've specialized in early Christianity and the late antique and early medieval. So I've written a bunch of books on that subject, and it's what I do for fun.
What led you to write a biography of Galla Placidia?
Well, I'm interested in biography in a particular way. I'm less interested in sort of the arc of a biography of a person's life, you know? I'm really interested in seeing their context. Sometimes we're shaped by what goes on around us, and sometimes in weird ways, our presence shapes larger forces. So in this biography and in others I've written, you'll see I weave in a lot of information. Just to give you one quick example to give you an idea, Placidia's brother, the emperor, passed a law banning Romans from wearing trousers. Okay, that, you know, seems a little odd, but not when you notice that she ran off with a barbarian wearing trousers. So you could see that things are linked in this web of history, and I like tracing all of these threads. So that's what I try to do.
I liked it a lot because I felt that what you did by doing that was you helped to underscore, among other things, her significance as a figure, which is something that not necessarily every biography does. Sometimes you study a life in isolation and you miss the degree to which it impacted the times in which the person lived. And I felt that by doing that, that really came out, the degree to which she was involved in these events and also how these events helped to illustrate aspects of her life that we oftentimes miss.
Great. It worked then.
Because the context is so important, I was wondering if you could start us off by explaining a bit about the context of the world into which Galla Placidia was born. What was the Roman Empire like during that time, and what were some of the key issues that they were dealing with that would have a major influence upon her life?
Okay, so we've got the late 4th century. So let's say from 376, but we won't quibble about a year or two. All right, so during the late 4th century, Rome was confronting two major things that would dramatically shift this empire that had stood for over 400 years. One was the politics. These barbarian tribes were coming roaring into the empire in bits and pieces, in waves, in trickles. So Rome had to confront a whole new influx of people and a new influx of cultures. And if I could say it parenthetically, I have colleagues who suggest that the influx of refugees into Europe today parallels this early influx of people of a different culture speaking different languages roaring into the empire. So the Roman Empire had to deal with this politics of that. Secondly, the dramatic change that was going on, Placidia's father, Theodosius I, had declared that Christianity was the only religion legal in the empire. So now you had the Roman Catholic Church. So all Romans were Christians. And then he died, which was sort of convenient. But that left his children to sort out, including Galla Placidia, by the way, to sort out, okay, how does that work exactly? How are Romans Christians? So you see this intersection between the politics of barbarians and the politics of religion conspiring to change the empire from what it had been before. And Galla Placidia is in the center of that.
And
is that enough context, or you want some more?
Well, I was going to also mention that that's also complicated by the fact that in some ways we're beginning to talk not about one empire, but about two. And I was wondering if you could explain that structure, because as you describe in your book, that also plays a role in her life, the fact that you're talking about a Western Roman Empire and an Eastern Roman Empire as well.
Yes, perfect. So Theodosius had three children, as we'll see. Two sons, Arcadius and Honorius. And Theodosius thought both sons deserved to be emperors. So for convenience, he divided the emperor empire administratively into the East and the West. It had been done before, and he continued it. So his son Arcadius ruled in the East from the city of Constantinople, and Honorius ruled in the West, which would have been from Rome. His court was in Milan. So here you have this, for administrative purposes, the empire was in two parts, but both ruled by the house of Theodosius. And this is significant because, you know, here's the thing. Once Theodosius declared the empire Christian, he and others around him said God was on the side of the house of Theodosius. So now the ruler of the empire shifts from being, oh, the guy with the strongest arm or the strongest army, to being the one with the blood of Theodosius in his veins, or her veins, as we will see, because God's on their side.
As you explained, though, in the book, and as I think you'll illustrate when we're going over her history, that doesn't necessarily prove to be enough, that you still need to have a nice strong army and an ability to command their loyalty in order, if you're going to remain in power.
Yes, and you need a strong general. I mean, both these sons of Theodosius were useless. Arcadius in the East, a local sort of chronicler who was kind of on his side, said he is led around like an ox, if that's the best thing you can say about him. You know, Honorius in the West was just as bad. He hung out with his eunuchs in the court. To be honest, he couldn't dredge up enough energy to consummate his marriages. You know, so here we have neither of them are warriors, so both will have to rely on strong generals. Well, if you have a family who's relying on strong generals, a woman can do that too, and just as effectively.
And that raises one of the interesting questions about Placidia relative to her brothers, which is, what was it about her childhood and upbringing that made her so much more effective of a leader than either of her brothers, who, as you describe in the book, were literally born into the purple?
Yep, and stay there. Well, it's funny. It's so tempting to do a kind of psychology backup on this, but of course one really can't prove it. But what we can look at are the facts. The thing was, Theodosius was married twice. His first wife produced these two boys, and then she died. When he married the second wife, then she produced the daughter, Galla Placidia. So you have step situations, right? So the brothers never approved of the stepmom. There's an old story, isn't it? And so they for sure didn't like the stepsister. So she was alienated from this court from the beginning. She wasn't raised with that kind of pampered privilege. And the other thing we know about her is that irritated her. She believed she should be empress, and she worked very hard to get the title and the status. So what we see here is a young girl raised on the outside, looking at these pampered, useless brothers of hers and thinking, well, I like to translate it loosely, I can do that better than that. You know? So when opportunity strikes, she's got the wherewithal. She does it.
How was it that she developed this wherewithal? Was it a function of anything that her mother did? Was it her education? How was she raised?
Well, she was raised, her father died when she was young, and her mother had died before that. So she was an orphan. So who was going to raise her? Well, as we've seen, stepbrothers were not any candidates for this task. But she was raised by Stilicho and his wife. He is a general who was the strong right arm of the Emperor Honorius in the West. Stilicho essentially ruled for 13 years, keeping the empire safe from Goths, keeping the emperor on the throne. And Galla Placidia was raised in his household. His wife, Serena, was careful that she was raised as Roman daughters should be raised. She got a great education. She could read Greek. She could read Latin. She could read law. We know she had a good background in the law, history, military history. She was also raised to weave and spin. She was raised with religion. She was raised to be a perfect empress. But what Stilicho was thinking was that if all else failed, she could marry his son, and then his family would rule. So she had a really, you know, wise upbringing. But what's interesting to me, this is her stepmother who's raising her.
And it's interesting how, even though she is being raised with so many of the skills necessary to rule, as you explained, she's in a sense still being expected to play this secondary womanly role and not necessarily to become an empress in a ruler in her own right.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll see that play out. Well, I see in the course of this hour, I hope into the next generation. She's raised to rule, but to raise to be a proper woman. So it's an interesting dilemma. And we can see that, at least what I consider evidence, that she resents the stepmother is when she has an opportunity, she makes sure the stepmother is executed. Like, okay, no love lost there. But so she's raised in the household, she's got the skills, and we're waiting for her opportunity.
You mentioned Stilicho. Could you explain a bit about him and how it was he came to serve as Placidia's surrogate father?
Sure. Theodosius, before he died, knew he needed a strong general to help Honorius through his majority. And so he selected Stilicho. He was half barbarian. He was a great general. He was very loyal to the Theodosian family. And Stilicho had his own desires to rise in to the imperial title. And he had two daughters and a son. So here we go. We got some spouses available for Honorius and perhaps for Galla Placidia. So Stilicho was well motivated to keep the empire safe. And in fact, Honorius ended up marrying his first daughter, Maria. She died as a virgin. Honorius married his second daughter, who was sent home as a virgin, both unconsummated. So you could see Stilicho had a motivation to be loyal to the house of Theodosius. And he was a great general. So that's where he was. You know, he was really a good, reasonable choice for Theodosius. And he held the barbarians at bay until 408 when he died. So here we have the situation then in 408. Let me sort of lay it out here. The greatest of the barbarian tribes were the Goths. They were raiding the Balkans. They were a big army, 100,000 people and more. And Stilicho repeatedly had to battle with the leader of the Goths, Alaric. And in 408 then, Stilicho's dead. Alaric raiding into Italy. Honorius runs, no problem. He takes his court over to Ravenna behind marshes. He, in a sense, can say, all right, let the barbarians rampage in Italy. Me and my court are fine behind these marshes and walls of Ravenna. And then Galla Placidia is in Rome with Serena, the wife of Stilicho. So here you have the barbarians at the gates, and that's when Galla Placidia sells out Serena and gets her executed by the Senate. And the problem is the Goths are at the gates. So here we have this situation that this tentative balance of power, which had Stilicho against Alaric, had fallen apart. The Goths are way ahead now.
And this leads, of course, to one of the epic moments in the history of the Roman Empire.
410, Rome was sacked by the Goths. It's held up as this horrible event. Probably wasn't as horrible as the subsequent raiding was, because Alaric was outside. there was hunger in Rome. There was famine, and Honorius wasn't coming to help. He didn't have the troops. So someone inside Rome opened the gates for him, probably a woman, Proba, who said, and apparently he was negotiated because Alaric told his troops, you get 3 days to sack the city. You got to give your guys time to sack. And yet you have to stay away from the churches. So St. Peter's outside the wall and St. Paul's outside the walls were going to be sanctuaries for Christians, because Alaric too was a Christian. And everybody's a little nervous about having, you know, putting God on somebody's side or not. You know, you want to be a little careful about that. And so it was a plan. 3 days of raiding, leaving the Christians pretty much alone. Portions of the city got burnt, but not the whole city. And they captured Galla Placidia. They found such a prize. I mean, they loaded up their wagons with wealth and everything Rome had. And they thought the daughter, the sister of the emperor, was the best prize of all. And they expected to get lots of ransom from her. Of course, I'm picturing the correspondence with Honorius, and the emperor says, keep her. I never liked her that much anyway. You know, take her. But
there's always those sibling problems.
Oh, I know. You have to be sure you know what you got. But to see here what Honorius knew, but not yet, if you wanted the next person to rule to be from the house of Theodosius, that goes through Placidia's womb, not through Honorius, since he wasn't consummating any marriages. So he hadn't thought it through to think about, hang on, I better get my sister back here. But he'll think about that later.
Well, that points to what you talk about in the book about the poor quality of Honorius and Arcadius as emperors, which also raises the question, because as you describe, in lieu of their own will and ideas, they tend to be manipulated by or directed by the officials around them. And it's interesting as to, give what you described, the sources probably don't help us here, as to whether or not they picked up on it, or maybe it got into the mill of court politics, and they all figured that maybe they were better done without her, or something like that, perhaps.
Well, they really needed her, because maybe he hoped the barbarian would kill her, whatever, you know? But what's also surprising to me is, all right, she's kidnapped. They've raided Rome. Where are they going to go? They wander around sacking places in Italy for literally years. So you have these rampaging 150,000 or more barbarians raiding from Tuscany all the way down to the tip of Italy, to trying to get to Sicily. They never get there. But they're wandering back and forth. Now, here, I want to sort of stop a minute and talk about religion for a minute, okay? If you don't, little small religion digression here, because it's central to this story. Because what you have here is you have many of the Romans who escaped went down to North Africa, and it seemed like the world had collapsed. You know, they thought God was on the side of Rome. They thought God was on the side of Theodosius. How could they let the city of God be sacked, you know? Can you imagine what kind of crisis of confidence that created? Well, the person they ran into down there was Augustine, the greatest mind theologian in the West. So they had people who went to Augustine and they said, explain to us how God let this happen. And I love that we have some, I've written on Theodosius, on Augustine a lot. So I'm always interested in his sermons. And he has some early sermons when he says, essentially, God didn't destroy Rome. It just smacked it. You know, get over it. Well, that's not very satisfying when your home's been burnt and you're a refugee. So someone went to Augustine and said, look, could you just really write a book that explains all this? The emperor's daughter, the sister's been kidnapped. Rome has been destroyed. How are we to understand this? And he wrote the most influential book in theology and Christian history, The City of God. And so in this, he explains that, well, really, he recasts Christianity. God doesn't vote for one city. Rome isn't the city where God lives. God lives somewhere else. The city of God is in heaven. And the local cities, it's just permeated by, we might say, holiness rays from the city of God. So the city of God isn't Rome. The city of God is the Christians who live within Rome. So Rome wasn't destroyed. The city of God wasn't destroyed. It was only the pagan city. You follow that? It's kind of like a nuanced argument.
Yeah,
but what it does,
is
it lets, yeah, you see, it changes the thing.
Mm-hmm. It also makes for an interesting contrast with the sacking that you describe, because from what Augustine writes, it seems as though it's this destructive event, the equivalent of, say, you know, a mighty bomb going off, and yet you describe it being much more orderly. So the fact that Augustine writes a book like that, trying to rationalize this event, shows how large it must have loomed for the people of that time to have had Rome, you know, sacked, even though, as you described, just 3 days. It didn't seem like that to them at the time, certainly.
Right.
What was Placidia's life like
with the
gods?
Such a huge thing.
Yes.
Well, and this, I can only kind of vaguely untangle it, but it was very interesting because she's obviously traveling in an ox cart, because that's how all the Goths traveled, this long train of ox carts. And they treated her, according to sources, in accordance with her status. So that means she was well treated. She was put under guard by Alaric's brother-in-law, Athos. And he was, well, handsome and, as barbarians go, very nice looking and smart, and they hung out together. And according to the sources, in the course of this his guard, they're hanging out as they travel, I mean, literally for years, Athos came to appreciate her wisdom, her knowledge of the law, her knowledge of other things. And, well, did they fall in love? Maybe. I don't know. But they certainly decided to get married.
It's also interesting that those traits are mentioned because it suggests that he saw her as more than just a woman who could bear children who would give them entree into the Theodosian line.
Absolutely. And all the sources indicate that anything like that was her idea. That he was looking for a homeland to set up his Goths somewhere. They were looking at the Balkans because that's where Alaric wanted his homeland. But in the course of talking to Placidia, she seemed to change her mind in several fronts. In the first place, they decided to go to Spain. Giant change. Her Theodosian family was from Spain, and she had stories and had heard. She had never been there, but she had heard about what a great land it was. And so then all this parade of Visigoths, instead of marching around Italy waiting for Honorius to do something, decided to cross the Alps and go settle in Spain, which, since we know the future, the Visigothic kingdom was set up in Spain. So we know that worked. So the second thing she seemed to have persuaded him of was that maybe the Roman law is a good thing. And so we get writings of Visigothic laws. She wants them to follow law. And finally, she has a different idea, and even Athelf reports this. He thought he would have a Visigothic kingdom of his own. She thought that the Visigoths and Romans would combine, and he would rule the whole empire. So there we have the blood of Theodosius being offered up as a way to rule and get rid of her brother, whom she never liked. So they cross the Alps, and they get married in Narbonne. And we can again see her sort of fingerprints on this, because we have a description of the wedding, and the wedding is straight up Roman. He dresses in Roman armor with a Roman imperial robe on. She dresses as a Roman. They're married in a Roman villa. They follow the Roman tradition, and he gives her huge gifts. Okay, they were raided from Rome in the first place, but fair enough. She gets all these jewels back. I mean, he had to get them somewhere. But, you know, so they have this giant Roman wedding in Narbonne. Now She has laid down the gauntlet. She says, in a sense to her brother, I'm creating a new empire. I have my husband. I have the blood of Theodosius. We are going to challenge you. Can you imagine how angry Honorius was? He was beside himself.
How far did that challenge get before Atulf died?
Not far enough, sadly, I think. Well, and the thing was, Honorius had his new strong right arm, his new general, a man named Constantius III. And Constantius, he had his eye on the imperial throne. And the only way he could get it was to marry Placidia. So here we have him furious that Placidia undercut him and married the barbarian. So they moved on down. Placidia duly got pregnant. They settled in Barcelona. And if you ever go to Barcelona, which I recommend, of course, it's a wonderful city. They have a statue of Atulf. They have Atulf Road. And they have a wonderful museum, archaeological museum, excavated under the Barrio Gótica, which is the Gothic quarter of Barcelona, and where they lived. And you can see literally the streets where Placidia walked, by the laundry and the wine store from her palace. So they set up shop there in the beautiful walled city of Barcelona. And she had her baby. And she gave the baby the imperial name Theodosius. In case there was any doubt, she gave that child her father's name. He was going to rule. Which looked perfectly.
So what happened? What happened to the baby?
The baby died. The baby grew ill in the summer, didn't even make it to a year old. And the two of them buried the child in a little silver sarcophagus out of town. And we'll come back to that child. She excavates him at the end of her life. She still remembered him fondly. And then, presumably, she and Atulf were planning to have more children. But Visigoths were violent folks. Atulf was in the stable tending to his horses, and one of his men stabbed him, and Atulf died. That was sort of the death of a dream. And essentially, Placidia was sent back to her brother Honorius. But in the course of that, what have we got there? The Visigoths are established as federates of Rome. They're, in a sense, normalized that to have the Visigothic kingdom, which extended from southern France all the way down to Spain. And then when she went back, delivered back to her brother in Ravenna, she took her Visigothic guard, she took the money, and she was always favored the Visigoths. So suddenly, these people who were barbarians rampaging are now part and parcel of the Roman Empire in a good standing because of Placidia's marriage and her continued support of the Visigoths. So then she gets back to Rome, to Ravenna. Well, her brother had already decided he wanted her to marry this Constantius. And she said, no, no, no. And he didn't care whether she said no. He grabbed her hand, handed her over to Constantius, and she was remarried. So that's husband number two for her.
Did she ever warm to Constantius? Because from what you write in the book, he's pretty impressive person in his own right. He goes from being a soldier in Britain to becoming this leading general.
Yes, he was fairly impressive, but he wasn't, well, I guess you would say he wasn't likable, and she never liked him. And she did dutifully have two children, we might say the heir and the spare, Valentinian, her son, and her daughter, Honoria. Shortly after she's had those two, Constantius dies in surprising circumstances. The sources don't really suggest she poisoned him, but, I'm always suspicious when people just happily die so conveniently. But she has the heir, Valentinian, and the daughter, Honoria. Now, I want to say, let's look back at her childhood for a minute, because this part of the story is you know, history repeats itself, but never quite the same, you know? Placidia remembered how she hated her brothers, how they resented her, how she wanted to have the title empress as well. So she wanted to try to make sure that her daughter and son wouldn't have this competition going on in their lives. So she very quickly gave her daughter the title of Empress Augusta, almost the same time she gave her son the title of Emperor. Her daughter had her own money, her own palace as she was growing up, and her own title. And well, sort of combat happens to her. Yes, with women's history, very often you can have all the money and the title, but without power, without some sort of entree into a legitimate, what we might say, a job, they're not satisfied. And Honoria wasn't. So we'll see what happens with that. But Placidia became regent on her own. For 20 years, she ruled as her children, almost 20 years as her children grew up. So she got what she wanted. She ruled in the West, especially once her brother died too, I should mention.
So did she become regent because of her brother's inability to produce an offspring, or were there some additional machinations that brought her to that position?
Well, as long as her brother didn't produce offspring, so that was part one. On her brother's good side while he was alive, to be sure she wouldn't be, you know, treated badly. She also had to run off to Constantinople with her children to make friends with the eastern part of the court so they would support her. I mean, there were endless numbers of people aspiring to the throne in the West to try to get rid of her and her family. But she made it all work. She was really quite enterprising, quite the strong political woman and the strong religious woman at this point. You know, some of the things that we see that theology worked out, it wasn't just the City of God, but we can trace, for example, theologians write about how the Virgin Mary becomes important in religion and in studying, and or those beautiful mosaics in Ravenna. After you go to Barcelona, I recommend Ravenna so you can see these magnificent, put it on your travel list. You can see these magnificent mosaics that she designed, and it's a vision of heaven and holiness that she inspired. You can really see it. And she, in her honor, the Pope built the great church, Santa Maria Maggiore. It's the old 5th century church, and there's a mosaic there of the Virgin Mary that's the spitting image of another image we have of Galla Placidia. So she becomes literally the image of the heavenly empress as she rules. So her hand on things influences military policy. She has to juggle various generals, and by the way, now Huns are rolling in, as if you don't have things bad enough. The Goths weren't bad enough. You got the next batch, which are Huns coming pressing. She's got to negotiate all of these problems. The Vandals attack North Africa. And at the same time, she has her hand of the West through this late 4th, early 5th century as she guides everything. Quite an amazing accomplishment, I think.
What were some of the greatest challenges that she faced in particular? Because you spent some time talking about all the challenges, but there's some that seem to have played a greater role than others in terms of dictating the issues of a regency.
Well, one that I particularly like because of the irony of the thing. Well, I don't know if you can like a challenge, but I guess you can. I mentioned the Huns are coming in. All right, so you have Attila the Hun. Everybody's heard of him. He came in raiding, plundering, and by the way, he was called the Scourge of God because they kept having to raise this question, why is God allowing Attila to beat all our armies? And the answer was, well, God is using him to punish us for misbehaving. So, there, you know, there always has to be God's plan in this. But you've heard of Attila the Hun coming raiding. But what most people haven't heard of is Placidia's daughter's role in this. Now, we have these two kids. We have Valentinian, who is now emperor, and you have Honoria, who has the title empress. She's got her own money, she's got her own life, and she's got no power. But she has a great idea. She sends her ring to Attila the Hun and proposes marriage to him. Really? Was that a good idea? So here, again, I sort of loosely translate it. Well, mom had a barbarian. Maybe I can get me one, too. So she sends her ring to Attila the Hun. He comes in to claim his bride. Her notion was she would split the Western Empire, and her brother could have Italy, and she would take Gaul with her husband, Attila the Hun. Well, you know, as I said, history repeats itself, but not quite. Attila was no Athos. He was a pagan who had three wives already. I'm not sure what she was thinking, but she was thinking that she would use this bit of power. Well, can you imagine how angry her brother was when he discovered that little plot? The only wonder is that he didn't kill her right away. Galla Placidia intervened to keep the daughter alive and have her marry a senator to keep her safe. Well, she was kept safe only until Galla Placidia died, and then suddenly the Honoria disappears from history. But consider this. So you have this notion of a new barbarian coming down. Why didn't he succeed? Well, the famous piece of it is that the Pope confronts the Attila the Hun at Lake Garda and says, God won't let you come any further, go home now. Well, Attila's army was full of sickness, and he had revolts at home, so sure, he had to go back again. He had to leave, and then leaving his bride-to-be, Honoria, in the lurch. Attila left, and by the way, he died. He married a new young bride and died in the bridal bed after having had too much to drink. Is there some irony there? Maybe. I don't know. But one of the challenges Placidia faced was these incoming Goths and the loss of North Africa to the Vandals, because and took over. She had to negotiate a marriage to keep the Vandals at bay. But the point is, she did. You know, when Gibbon talked in The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he blamed the fall of the Roman Empire on Placidia and other empresses. No, I mean, the empire should have fallen. She held it together, I think you could safely say. But, yeah.
It's interesting how she had all the skills to do that her brothers, who were better positioned to do so, never did. And it really is an interesting commentary about sort of the gender roles and gender attitudes, and how on one level, even in spite of them, she could, you know, assume this role and play this successful role as a manager of the empire for as long as she did.
And I don't know. I'm as a mother and grandmother, I always often wonder, what is it that makes one kid be able to rally and turn out great, and others are perhaps not as well as others might, you know. And you just can't predict, can you? You know, here you have these emperors who have these pampered sons. You see it repeatedly. Roman emperors produce good for nothings. And one of the things that I see repeatedly in looking over women in the past is that if there's a vacuum, sometimes that's when you can get a strong woman to rise and make it on her own. You know, if these brothers were totally competent, she might have been equally competent, but without the opportunity to step up and accomplish something. And then you get something like her daughter, Honoria, who believed she was just as competent as her mom, but picked the wrong barbarian. You know, sometimes people are lucky, but sometimes not so much.
I'm also thinking that Honoria's assumption there really speaks to also the fact that, you know, Placidia was such a very visible role model
to
have
done something
like that, and to have her daughter say, wow, if my mom could do that, then maybe I could do the same thing too.
I know. How do we know what model we give our daughters and our sons for that matter, right? Well, and it even gets worse, actually, because, well, after, I'll jump ahead briefly, after Placidia dies, her son, Valentinian, really screws everything up and dies. Valentinian's wife was so angered, so that's Placidia's daughter-in-law, was so angered at her husband's death that she looked around and she thought, maybe I can find a barbarian who will help me out of this and get even. So she invited the Vandals from North Africa to come up and save her. Well, they really plundered Rome. Our term vandalism and Vandals comes from the 455 devastation of Rome by the Vandals, as Placidia's daughter-in-law invited her own barbarian to town. Maybe the moral of the story is don't bet on barbarians. I don't know.
or it could speak to the fact that Placidia's skills were such that she was able to manage barbarians in a way that that nobody else following her ever could.
I like that moral better. That's much better. Yeah.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, I'd be delighted to. I've just completed a great course on the history of Spain, which is why Barcelona's on my mind. And they have just contracted me to do 36 women, ancient women, from the year 1 to the year 1400. So I get to revisit biographies and biographies of women, integrating them so deeply into their time and spaces. So a year, you'll see the great course come out on my biographies of ancient women.
That sounds like a fantastic project. I do look forward to listening to it. Well, Joyce Salisbury, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot. It was great.